Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies. I talk to experts. I tell stories about what worked, but also what failed for me. Because ultimately, I believe that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And so we sometimes talk about AI, project-based learning. We talk about what it means to empower students with voice and choice in a world that is often chaotic and difficult, where they are going to have to navigate a maze of uncertainty. And today we're talking about the topic of empowering students to self-select scaffolds and supports. And before we get there, I want to say, if you have not subscribed to my newsletter, go check out spencereducation.com and you'll get my latest resources, emails, podcasts, all sent to your mailbox, or your inbox, not mailbox. That would be cool though. Your inbox every week. In fact, I just today sent out an email with a full lesson plan, slideshow, everything for something called the FACTS prompt engineering process for AI. So I love sharing things for free with you. And then also, if you would love professional development, if you're interested in that at all, click on the speaking section of my website and fill out the form. And I would love to get a chance to be in your school, your district, wherever that is as well. So without further ado, let's jump right into today's topic. When I was a new teacher, I had the goal of differentiating instruction for every student. I would provide additional directions, project sheets, tutorials, and small group instructions for any student who needed help. My main focus was providing the necessary accommodations on IEPs and 504 plans. I kept a list of specific strategies I would use in every phase of a lesson to help ensure that all students had access to the necessary accommodations. And I also included language supports for ELL students, including things like sentence stems, vocabulary, visuals, you name it. So that was my goal, right? And this process sometimes felt overwhelming in classes with 8 to 10 students who needed specific accommodations, but I would do it. I often had a nagging sense that I was failing, and I felt like some of my students who were not special ed, who were not neurodivergent, things like that, students who were not English language learners or multilingual students, they weren't getting necessary supports, but I was just trying to do my best. At one point, I had the goal of providing a specific scaffold for every student. So I was like, I'm gonna find out what each student needs and design based upon their mastery of certain standards. But this process was absolutely overwhelming to me. I mean, I just couldn't do it all. And so then I began to think about this idea of empowerment. And I had begun with this question of, what am I doing for students that they could be doing for themselves? And I actually made a list of everything possible. But still, scaffolds was not really one that I came up with initially. I still wasn't thinking about scaffolds and supports. But my mindset was starting to think about empowerment. It was starting to think about voice and choice. And over time, I began to empower students to own things like the assessment process. And that was helpful, but I still wasn't there. And eventually, I reached a place where I would empower my students to own the scaffolding process. And this shift was all because of a teacher that I met named Crystal. She was an amazing special ed teacher. She's now a professor. And she was the one who convinced me that I needed to trust my students to be advocates for themselves and to self-select the scaffolds that they need. For a few years, I had thought about empowerment, but I hadn't even considered what it might mean to let students self-select scaffolds until Crystal introduced me to something called Universal Design for Learning. And I'll be getting into that today. I absolutely promise. And what happened is I soon realized that I hadn't given students the opportunity to advocate for themselves and to find the scaffolds that they needed. And so when I made this shift, I found that students were more aware of their mastery. They seemed to persevere and continue more easily, and they grew more confident as learners. So yes, they got the scaffolds that they needed, but more importantly, they became advocates for their own learning, and I think that's really important. So let's think about this for a moment. Part of our goals, or one of the goals of being an educator, is that we want to provide just enough help. You probably notice that there are certain things that you can do on your own and certain things that are impossible, but then there are these things in the middle zone that you can't do on your own quite yet, but you can accomplish with a little help. That help might be a teacher, it might be a parent or guardian, it might be a peer, but it could also be resources, things from a book, a video, a podcast. It could be an AI chatbot, fictional relationship. And note that this is true not only for gaining new skills, but also for learning new information or understanding new concepts. The educational theorist Lev Vygotsky called this space the zone of proximal development. He developed this idea as a criticism of things like the psychometric testing in education, which viewed intelligence as both permanent and fixed. So what he was advocating for was sort of a more adaptive approach and an understanding that we're much more malleable than we first seem. Now, here's how the ZPD works. At the center, I want you to imagine you have what you can do on your own. Then you have this outside circle, and that's things that you cannot do at all and things that are just impossible. But then in between this outer circle and this inner circle, you have this middle zone called the zone of proximal development. And these are the things that you can do, but they require guidance and support. That's the ZPD. Now, in 1976, Jerome Bruner applied Vygotsky's theory to the educational setting with the concept of scaffolding. And the key thing to understand here is scaffolding is what we see on a regular basis. It's what we do. It's been a part of our educational system for a long time. And educators provide supports, which he called scaffolds, just like the scaffolding of a building. And students sort of climb the scaffolding to get to the learning that they need. So then, like the scaffolding in a building, the teachers pull back the scaffolds as students master the knowledge and the support becomes unnecessary. And at this point, if we go back to that image of the ZPD, that zone of proximal development, it grows outward and outward and outward and expands. And so you have this ever-expanding center of what kids are capable of doing. With scaffolds, you tap into prior knowledge and build upon it with key supports. And these supports could be tutorials, videos, visual aids, you name it. Very similar to the notion, again, of a ZPD. They might involve, you know, sentence stems or front-loaded vocabulary for English learners. It could be leveled reading, graphic organizers, you name it. The key thing is that we want to provide those so students move out into independent learning. We know that scaffolds are important. We all can agree on this as educators. But, and I think this is important, it can feel impossible to provide just the right scaffolds for each student. With 30 students in a class, it can feel overwhelming to provide the exact support each student needs for each lesson you teach. We don't know at all times what a student's mastery level is or how they're doing. And it could take hours to design the exact scaffold for every student. And yet, if we differentiate instruction, we need to help move students through this zone of proximal development. So what does that mean? What does that look like? Well, I think the key thing here is to avoid what's called learned helplessness. I promise we're going to get to the empower side here in just a moment. One of my biggest challenges as a teacher has been figuring out how to help students reach the ZPD, or sort of the outer edges of the of the ZPD. It sounds good in theory, but how do we make it into a daily reality? It's a bit easier for me at the university level where I don't have, 150 students the way I did in the middle school level. But I used to really struggle with differentiated instruction, with the scaffolding and supports. Now, part of this had to do with the assessment process. I just didn't always know what supports each student needed. I also struggled to craft better scaffolds and supports when I was already doing things like, teaching, preparing lessons, assessing work, conferencing, going to IEP meetings, coaching. You get the idea. Teachers never have enough time. Still, another challenge simply involved the process, the logistics of getting the right supports in real time to each student. At times, I failed to hold students to high expectations. I admit this. I simply lowered my standards at times to something that I thought the students could accomplish, or I would step in too early with scaffolds and they wouldn't experience productive struggle. We can think of this as a grid. We have high expectations and low expectations. We have, on the other hand, learner supports, high support, low support. If you give students a lot of support with low expectations, that's going to lead to learned helplessness. If you give students, low supports with low expectations, they're just going to underachieve. If you give them low supports with high expectations, you're going to end up with frustration. The reality is we need high support, but also high expectations. And that's where you get productive struggle, but that is very hard to do. And so given that reality, I want to share three different models that we can take. And this is from my book, Empower, that I wrote a long time ago, but I think it's true now. And so I'm going to share it. In my book, Empower, that I co-wrote with my good friend, AJ Giuliani, I shared the metaphor of ice cream as a way to think about differentiated instruction. A few years later, it's still my favorite way of thinking about the process. And when I say a few years later, it's almost a decade later, so it's been a while. Baskin-Robbins offers 31 flavors. The rotation changes each month, so I'm guessing there's probably hundreds of flavors at Baskin-Robbins. And by the way, I love Baskin-Robbins. Now, that would be differentiated instruction. But if you're looking for something much more specific that nobody in their right mind would offer, you might need to go to a place like Cold Stone Creamery. And I promise I'm not getting paid to promote Cold Stone. But you can order something like a hot fudge peanut butter and pretzel ice cream. Nobody else is choosing that flavor. It's yours. You get to decide it. Now, that would be student-led. It's driven by student choice, and it would be probably what we call something more personalized or adaptive. But if you want to own the entire process, you need to go to a frozen yogurt place. I know that it's not really ice cream, but let's be real. Froyo is just ice cream pretending to be yogurt. It's the same thing. And the thing about frozen yogurt is you own the process. So it's not just student-led student choice. It's built on empowerment. So when we shift from differentiation to something much more personalized, much more empowered, we can get to a place where students are shifting in their agency, their sense of ownership, their sense of control from compliance or even engagement into empowerment. And that needs to happen when it comes to having students select the scaffolds and supports. Now, how do we get there? A part of how we do this is through something called universal design. I promised that I would talk about that, and that's where we are right now. So years ago, when I taught middle school social studies, I worked with a special education teacher named Crystal, the one that I mentioned earlier, who really transformed the way I thought about scaffolds. One of her chief goals was that she wanted there to be no visible distinction between learners with exceptionalities, like special ed students, and the rest of the classroom population. Similarly, she wanted to be a co-teacher in a way that was really built on co-teaching. So we're both teaching together. As she put it, inclusion needs to mean full inclusion. My initial response was, honestly, skepticism. I remember telling her, you know, what if a student uses a scaffold that they don't need? What if general education students use an accommodation that's meant for a special education student? And I was legitimately concerned about sort of like the watering down of standards as I saw it. And her response was simple. Special education is a service, not a student. We teach students, we provide services. She then asked me if I ever used a curb cut or a ramp on the sidewalk. Yeah, they come in handy when I push a stroller, I told her, which at the time my kids were much, much smaller. I mean, they are now 20, 18, and 16, but they were little at the time. Have you ever watched TV with closed captioning on? I nodded. That's universal design, she told me. If you're familiar with universal design, it's really built on this idea of providing scaffolds, supports, whatever, for all students. So a little bit of a background here. In the early 1960s, there was this visionary architect named Selwyn Goldsmith, and he designed the initial curb cut or the little ramp, those mini ramps on the curbs, to encourage people with limited mobility, often wheelchairs, to access city sidewalks. It was part of a larger movement led by disability advocates toward universal access in the built environment by changing policies, systems, and structures to promote full inclusion. In the last few decades, architects, product developers, and UX designers have embraced this philosophy of universal design. And the architect Ronald Mace sort of spearheaded this movement or brought it forward past Selwyn Goldsmith's ideas. And he describes it as the belief that the designed environment should be usable by all people, quote, without the need for adaptation or specialized design. So it's the notion of designing for everyone. This inclusive approach allows for everyone to benefit from designs. So that means a caregiver pushing a stroller can use curb cuts. I can use voice to text when I text, although I have to be careful sometimes because it sometimes messes that up, obviously. And that's the idea of universal design. Well, similarly, universal design for learning, or UDL, it applies the same philosophy of universal design to every aspect of the learning, from learning spaces to materials to instruction to assessment to classroom culture to behavior management. And it's built around this idea of cognitive neuroscience. So it's the notion of removing barriers while also keeping the learning challenging for all students. So going back to that grid that I mentioned, it's the idea of productive struggle for all students, but also at the same time being inclusive, making it accessible. Note that this process is built on the idea of student agency. So students get to self-select what they need. And so it's a shift from a paradigm of having sort of a deficit mindset to one of neurodiversity, from singular accommodations that you give to students to universally accessible scaffolds and supports that they can self-select. It's a shift from being more teacher-centric to student-centered. You get the idea. And I want to say that this process of self-selection isn't always automatic for all students. You might need to work with certain students on how to access the scaffolds or how to self-advocate for what they need. Often this works well as a partnership between general education teachers and special education teachers. I don't love either of those terms, but it's what we have. You know, earlier I mentioned Crystal, who would meet with students to help them set their goals, identify strategies, and design systems for finding the necessary scaffolds that they needed. One of her goals is that they would know the practicalities of their IEPs, even if they couldn't understand the really complex language that IEPs are typically written in. And then as the year progressed, her students would take more and more ownership in this process, and she would sort of blend into the background as she worked with all students, special ed or not. I want to point out something here. This is one of the things I love about AI. Generative AI has made it easier than ever to design high quality scaffolds and supports. In the past, I used to spend hours doing things like sentence stems or frames, however you term it, graphic organizers, checklists, simplified readings, changing the reading level, all of those types of things. And now it's just easier than ever to do this. You can create all kinds of scaffolds and supports in a matter of seconds. But I think it's important that the teacher's expertise is still honored here. AI can handle the repetitive groundwork, but we as educators need to step up and actually modify those scaffolds and supports so that students get exactly what they need. This is where the cyborg approach that you might have heard me talk about from Ethan Mollick comes in handy. It's the notion of saying, like, what does AI do well? Crafting fast results, looking at data, crunching data, all that kind of stuff, generating new content quickly. Whereas what do humans do well here? Content expertise, your knowledge of your students, your wisdom as an educator. And so you take what it creates and you make it your own. So teachers can use generative AI to create basic templates that work for many students, then modify it based on how, like what you know about your learners. You might start with a general graphic organizer for comparing themes across stories, and then adapt it to an English learner by adding some sentence starters or key vocabulary boxes. And you might take a basic project checklist and adjust it for a student who needs more flexibility or challenge. The AI can provide the foundation, but we ultimately shape it to fit the unique needs of our classrooms. Similarly, though, I think students can use generative AI to create their own supports. So I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but a student with ADHD might ask AI to help break down a project into smaller steps with time estimates, and then use the endowed progress effect to stay motivated and to understand the sense of urgency and progression that often ADHD students need. And I say that as someone with ADHD. Now, in the end, there are so many different ways to get here. And if you look at the blog post that corresponds to it, I have a list of, I think, let's see, 7 different practical examples. But the key thing is that you know what's best. You know what your students need, and you can provide the scaffolds for them. In the end, I think the key thing to recognize is that when we let students self-select scaffolds, when we empower them, it's not just something that makes it more feasible. It's not just something that makes it easier. It's not just something that saves time. It's ultimately something that empowers our students for an uncertain future. And that, I think, is what ultimately this is all about. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, Amazon, wherever it is that you get your podcasts? Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.